Hey there, it's Mike Tramp, and you're listening to White Line Fever, where rock and roll is still alive like it always has been and it always will be.
Okay, welcome to White Line Fever. This is the first part of this week's program, but our guest is someone you heard on the last program, and it's Bob Spencer from Rose Tattoo. Welcome back, Bob.
Thank you, Steve.
we're talking into either end of the phone. We could actually lean together and be like smoking one cigar from the towards the centre. But it's awful. It's an awful thought. But it's just because my voice is insanely loud. Bob, I want to talk about your solo album, Saints and Murderers, and there's so much to talk about it. I guess there's a lot of different subjects through there. There's a lot of different styles. But I love the I can't do that. My wife will kill me. So we'll just start with that because it's I just wondered what the story is behind that. I mean, there's some stuff on there that's quirky. You know, I don't know if it's quirky, like you were trying to come up with a quirky song, or it's just a thought that came into your head and you developed it. It's hard rock, but it's kind of playful. I just wondered. Well, we'll start with that one, and we'll go on to talk about more about the album. But where did the idea for that one come from?
Right, I like to amuse myself, that's one thing, as you probably know. The line came, it started with two lines of lyrics. One is that I've had in my head for years, he's a good little soldier, which is about a particular person I know who comes from a line of, let's say, army backgrounds, and it looks to me like he's one of those people that lives the life his family thinks he should be living rather than his own life.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's because I'm a good little soldier. Part two is that I was having lunch with a very dear friend of mine who's in a band that's famous, so I can't mention who he is, a few years ago. And he said that he'd just written a song and presented it to their singer. Their singer doesn't write. And their singer said, I can't sing that, my wife will kill me, because he's ruled, he's got a massive thumbprint in the middle of his forehead and he's ruled by his wife. And I said, hang on, I'm just writing that down. So they're the two things I had. Good little soldier, living a life that's not a real life, it's a pretend life. I can't sing that, my wife will kill me, which immediately morphed into I can't do that. And musically I wanted something that was really dumb. So the song is three notes, maybe, I think.
Three glorious notes.
It's just really, really dumb. And I wanted it to be... When I say I want things to be, I don't know how they're taken, because I'm not you, I'm not the listener. But my hope was that it would be a song that would bring a smile to the faces of men and women. So I was hoping that women would get a kick out of it. Yeah, that's what Harvey says, and I was hoping that...
My wife likes it. It's caught, sort of.
sort of.
Maybe a bit close to the bone a little.
So I was hoping that it would be a song that both men and women enjoy. And I love doing video. I love... If someone could please pay me to do videos, I'd be really happy. So the whole package was fun, recording the song and coming up with the dumbed down riff, and which I love. I like a lot of music with only one riff in it. I love African
and the
music.
Backing vocals are awesome, you know, the intro
and the two girls that you, if you mean the girls, the two girls at the very beginning of the video, Laura and Pam, are the two girls who sang on the song.
Do they also sing on Who Are These People? Are they? No, this
Who Are These People? The backing vocals are me, and my wife and stepdaughter.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, my stepdaughter refuses to sing now because she's 15 and too cool.
So, paint us a picture of what it's like to actually do an album like that all on your own. Like, you, one day you wake up, you decide you want to do it, and then I guess you did crowdfunding. You did Possible.
I did.
And you obviously did the videos yourself. I guess you had to find, you were in a studio or did you record at home? You mix it all yourself? Did you play every instrument? What's it like? What's a day in the life of someone doing that? And is it rewarding, or do you get to points in the process where you just feel like giving up, you know?
The answer to the question is yes. It's a massively eventful experience. Mm-hmm. So wake up in the morning, what would I do? One day I might put down bass, another day I might struggle for 4 hours with the guitar sound. Another day I might put down some vocals. It changed daily. And of course there was daily life to be led through the process. So stepdaughter needs to be driven. School, shopping, some cooking, walk the dog, blah, blah, blah. So it was not as regimented as I had hoped it would be. It was sometimes haphazard. Sometimes things worked out the way I wanted them to work out. Sometimes they didn't. It was frustrating. It was rewarding. It was maddening. It was delightful. Some things were just delightful, like putting down the vocal for Daylight, which is just a straight-out love song. I loved it. Just singing a love song with really simple lyrics was great fun. Other vocal performances were difficult. Difficult in that I've never sung before. I didn't really know I could sing anything. I've always hidden behind.
Yeah. I read that there was a story on musicfeeds.com.au about you having therapy to get over your nervousness, you know?
Yeah, not nervousness, fear. Yeah. Okay. Outright fear. And I did have therapy, and the therapy, although initially looked like it was going to be about the fear of singing, really became my fears about all sorts of things in life, of which singing was a part. Mm-hmm. But singing, it transpired that singing was not the central issue. Mm-hmm. And the therapy called EMDR was sensational. Mm-hmm. It really helped me in a lot of areas. Helped me enormously. So the process was, it was like alien landscapes. Mm-hmm. It was all over the place. Mm-hmm. But I didn't, as much as I planned, tomorrow I'll do vocal. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I open my mouth and thought, today is not the day I'm doing vocal. Yeah. I'll do tambourine. Mm-hmm. Or, or do some mixing. Or mm-hmm. Because these days with digital, you can start a mix and you don't have to complete it. And I also took the opportunity to study more audio things to do with engineering while I was going through the process. I learnt more about stuff, audio stuff, sonic stuff, oral stuff. So every day was different, a new experience, and it often threw up things that I wasn't expecting.
I've got two more questions and we'll play a song off the album. First is, listening to it today, I was thinking, like, you know, you're recording the guitars and then adding the drums and you're singing over the top of it, and it could sound technically good, but that oomph, that propulsive aspect that you get from having a group of people could be missing. And I just wondered whether that was a hurdle to overcome, that you go, well, everything fits together fine, but I'm not getting goosebumps, you know what I mean? Is that just a value judgment, or do you go to other people, or...?
Okay, I trust very few people. I trust an old and very dear friend of mine, Mark Tinson, in Newcastle. Mm-hmm. So occasionally I would throw him an MP3, and he came back with a couple of really interesting views. I didn't really let anyone else listen to anything, and I just trusted myself. I have no idea what other people think or were going to think about it. I just trusted myself. A compliment I have received, and I'm extremely happy about this, is that it sounds like a band. Mm-hmm. But it's not.
It does. Yeah.
I had three great drummers put down the drum tracks in four separate studios, which I will never do again because it was really difficult mixing and trying to get a cohesive sound through the album. That was very, very hard. So I will not do that again. Next album, one drummer, one room.
Do you digitally speed up and slow down the drum tracks? Or
No. Everything is as you hear. Very old school in that sense, that I treated the audio as though it were coming off a 2-inch 24 track. I didn't go copying and pasting and fixing all that stuff. If I sang out of tune, which I do, I did it again. If I didn't like my phrasing, I did it again. Something I remember is vocally, because I am aware that I'm not Stevie Marriott or Paul Rodgers or Rod Stewart, all I tried to bear in mind was deliver the song, sell the song, just sell the emotion of the song, and don't worry too much about sell the song. I don't mean that in a capitalistic way. I mean sell the song, deliver the song, deliver the song. That's what I kept in my head the entire time. Just deliver the song, and that's what got me through the vocal.
The other question, and we'll have a song after this, is the quantum leap from, I guess, being on Sounds with Donny Sutherland every Saturday morning and you know, and being on the radio when you get in the car, to doing an album on your own in a genre that is no longer part of the mainstream. So it doesn't matter how good the record is, you can't really hope to have enough people hear it. So the sort of what do you call it, the satisfaction and the feedback and the stuff that maybe you didn't realise you relied on before, but you were, and now it's absent. How do you get over that hurdle and get used to it, you know?
I didn't see it as a hurdle. For me, this was a cathartic experience, and it was something that I felt I just absolutely had to do. So I wasn't thinking in terms of hurdles. Just, that didn't enter my mind. I mean, when I choose to put that hat on, I can see the hurdles, but the basis of this was, I really need to get this stuff out of my system. I've also got enough material for two instrumental albums, or maybe more. Or an albums. I could do two albums of pretty songs, but I felt I needed to get this particular thing out of my system. So I didn't wake up and think, hurdle. I just did what I thought I needed to do.
Okay, let's have a song.
Oh, God. No, I didn't even get a chance to think about that. Is this going to be a rock kind of thing? If it's going to be a rock kind of thing, oh God, what are the songs on the album? Holy crap, I can't
think. What's that song I listened to today? What do you think about that? That's a good song. It's very uplifting, and it covers a lot of stuff we'll talk about in the next segment.
It does. Let's do, and that will be the next film clip, by the way. What do you think about that?
We all breathe the same air.
this is hey.
Why do we say hey? You're already there. I don't need to say hey. This is Bob Spencer, and you're listening to White Line Fever.
So, welcome back to the program, and we've got a great guest coming up now, and it's we only found out about it a few hours ago, but I'm glad he was able to join us at short notice. Corey Glover from Living Colour. How are you, Corey?
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing my best, hanging in there. Thank you very much. We're talking about another Australian tour, and I'm thinking that you've probably done, every second day for the last 2 years, you could be talking about an upcoming Australian tour. You're almost you're almost applying for residency.
I should.
What is it about you? Over the years, you've obviously had a great relationship with Australia. What do you think the key is there? What do you think the appeal is from both sides, I guess?
I think the appeal for us is that the audiences are great. You know, they know songs that, in some cases, they know songs we don't even play anymore, and which is a challenge for us to really try to work those songs up again.
Mm. So what are some of the, tell us some of the songs that you sort of have to work on before you go to Australia.
You know, the songs like I Want to Know, I don't know if we've played that since the 80s. let's see, what else is there? We started to play Which Way to America, and it was like, we got other stuff we could do. So we'll see what happens.
I was recently just here in London. I was at a show by a group of, you know, Australian Indigenous dancers, and they had a number of songs in their set, and one was Love Rears Its Ugly Head, and the English audience was like they sort of weren't aware of that song. It's a massive song in Australia, isn't it?
It's we had no idea how big a song it was until we got there, actually. Mm.
Yeah, and were you aware of this sort of group? I can't remember what they call this group. They're touring the world, and your song is kind of a centerpiece of their show. They're playing art centers all over the place, you know.
We had no idea.
Okay, I'll forward the name of them when we get off the phone.
You got it.
So what I was going to say, twice in 2 years, is that just because the promoter rings up and gives you an opportunity, or do you go there once and say, wow, this is awesome, we need to come back soon?
Yeah, up until now, it was a while before we had played there on our own.
Mm.
We went there on a festival 4 years ago and realized what fun it was to play in Australia, and we hadn't played in Australia in a while. So when the opportunity comes, we take it.
Yeah, yeah. Tell us about now looking back on the release of Shade, with a year and a bit. Have things gone exactly as you expected with the record? The way it's been received. Do you when a record comes out, do you have preconceptions about how it might be received?
Yeah, you do, but you have to throw those out the window, and you got to accept where people are, you know. We like people to know more about this record. I don't think it's got enough promotion or push. I think once people hear it, I think they'll like it, and it'll be a better sort of response to it. So we've been working at the idea of re-releasing the record at some point next year to get people more interested in the album.
All right. Will you have sort of extra bonus tracks or something when you do that?
Absolutely. Probably some live stuff from Australia.
Oh, right. Awesome. So, how does that kind of work when you make the decision to re-release it? Is it because you don't feel a vibe, or you don't feel the audience, the live audiences know the songs enough, or is it people who work with you who give you the advice to do that? What leads you to that decision?
The release of it last year, it got really good reviews, and a lot of people liked it, but I don't think a lot of people knew it was out. It was only in selected places that people knew it was out. We need a broader sort of appeal and a broader marketing push for people to actually know if the record is out, because some of these songs that we have on the new record are kind of what's going on today.
Mm.
And I think that people need to hear it.
Yeah, right. Okay. And how do you sort of make sure that it gets more attention this time? Like, what measures do you take to sort of make sure that it gets out there a bit more?
You have to. There's a lot of work involved, I imagine. You know, you'd have to. It has to be in the right places. The right people have to know that it's out there. It takes a lot more PR. It takes a lot more, you know, FaceTime. You know, a lot more television. A lot more radio. It's an effort to get people to hear it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, why don't we have a song, Corey? I guess you might want to play something from Shade, eh?
Yeah.
What can we play?
Let's play. Come on.
Tell you how I feel. Won't be afraid of what's being said. See, I won't scrape or kneel. The words form effortlessly from my mind to my mouth. Penetrates your skin like an original sin.
Okay, welcome back to White Line Fever, second part of interview with Rachel Bowler from Skid Row. I want to thank him for joining us. Long relationship and storied relationship with Kiss. I've seen you on the play on the Kiss cruise myself. How did you react to the news of the farewell tour, Rachel?
Yeah, I just heard about it the other day, and you know, being such a huge Kiss fan, it's sad in a way, but I mean, man, they've been doing it a long time. And man, I have the feeling it's not going to be their farewell tour. if you remember in 2000, we played the farewell tour. We opened up for them on the farewell tour. And we were out with them for about 9 months. So I have a feeling, as you know, as long as they could keep doing it, maybe they'll take a break. Maybe there'll be a decent hiatus. But I have a feeling we're not going to see the last of Kiss, you know.
And will you be part of it? Will Skid Row be part of it?
I would love to. I don't know whether it's got to that point yet, but yeah, we would love to be on that. Just how many times can you say you've been on farewell tour twice?
Yeah, you could put it in like Skid Row, open for Kiss on the farewell tour six times.
Yeah, exactly.
Speaking of big rock and roll tours, did you catch the GNR quote reunion tour unquote? And if you did, what did you think?
I did not. I did not see any of it. I heard it was great, and I heard that their playing and singing was, you know, really on point. But no, I didn't go to see it at all.
Right, you still got you've got a relationship with any of those guys, or is it? It's a long time ago now, I guess.
Yeah, I don't. I mean, the last guy I spoke to, which was a couple years back, was Duff, and he's as nice as always. Mm. You know, he's just a good dude and super nice guy. And that was the most recent time I've ever spoken to any of them.
Yeah, right. Okay, can we move on to like a motorsport and the fact that you're kind of like an athlete who's going out with painkillers every time you go on stage, just about, you know, like how is your injury with your back, and are you, I know that in Australia there are quite a few go-kart tracks around the place, and I think when you did open for Guns N' Roses, mentioning Guns N' Roses, you actually got under Calder Raceway with a real race car. So are you back kind of in competitive shape, or you're still ailing somewhat?
No, the back is fine. It was a herniated disc that was giving me all the problems. That's been fine. I took a year off of racing by suggestion of my doctor. Mm. And when he said, yeah, you could go back, just, you know, make sure you wear the Hans device and whatever, the head and neck restraint. Mm. And I got into it a little bit more in my go-kart, and then we just got really busy. And to tell you the truth, I haven't been in a car or a cart in quite some time, except for some fun with friends, you know. Mm. Nothing super competitive. But, yeah, I do plan on hitting those go-kart tracks in Australia, because there's some badass go-kart tracks there, man.
There's a lot of walk.
So, yeah, I plan on getting in them and having some fun.
Got a lot of wide open spaces. Okay, let's have another song, Rachel. We'll your time's valuable. What song can we play next?
Let's go off the first record. Let's do Making a Mess.
Oh yeah.
Rachel Bone from Skid Row, and you are listening to White Line Fever.
Welcome back to the program, and our next guest actually contacted us, so we must have at least one listener out there. we've got Tom here from Classic 78, and before I introduce Tom, I just want to explain who Classic 78 are. Played them two episodes ago, I think, and basically it's that band that sounded like it was Kiss. It's basically that Kiss song you heard that you'd never heard before two episodes ago. It actually wasn't Kiss. It was Classic 78. Welcome to White Line Fever, Tom.
Hey, Steve. Thanks for having me.
No, thank you for your time, and thanks for reaching out. Now, I'm sure most of these interviews people ask you to start at the beginning, but I've heard you do that a few times. So I want you to start at the most recent thing that's happened to Classic 78. What is actually going on now?
Right now, we're kind of laying low. Because there's so much going on in the world of KISS, and we have some material that we're sitting on that we feel really good about, but we want to make sure that we release it at the proper time because we don't want to get buried in all the hoopla about the KISS farewell tour and Bruce Kulick and Ace Frehley being on the cruise, and will those guys be on the tour, and is Vinnie Vincent going to ever do anything again? There's a whole host of things going on, and we want to make sure that if we release more music, that it's at the right time, so it gets its proper due in terms of those people out there who are waiting for more.
Yeah, are you guys, all three of you, are you totally day to day following the news cycle of KISS, or is it varying degrees amongst the three of you? Because obviously some people listening to this they kind of be vaguely aware of all the stuff you just mentioned, but it wouldn't be in the middle of their world, you know what I mean?
Right. Yeah, basically we're all KISS fans, and, to different degrees. Joe, who's one of the lead vocalists, who does all the Paul Stanley type of vocals, he's a fan of their entire career. I mean, he likes certain eras of the band better than others, but he's pretty day to day on what's going on with them. And myself, being a big Ace Frehley fan, I kind of keep tabs on things and see what's going on, because I just want to see how he's doing and if KISS are gonna use him or have him come do some appearances on the tour or not. So we're kind of regularly checking in on KISS news just as fans.
So what do you think the right time would be to release new material? Would it be with the tour underway, a couple of newspaper headlines, things that have sort of got poked through to the mainstream, are you going to wait till it's over, or are you going to wait till they have a break? What do you think the right time would be?
That's a good question, and I've been thinking about that. I'm thinking it's probably going to be after the tour starts, but I'll be surprised if we don't release anything during the tour. Mm-hmm. If we don't release anything while the tour is going on, it's just a scheduling issue on our end. But I think releasing the third release after the tour starts, maybe in March sometime. That's what I'm looking at.
Right. So the records, I guess they're EPs, and they're digital, aside from when you put out a box set called the Unoriginals, which is a cheeky title. Side one and side two, they've been available now for about a year and 2 years.
Coming up on 2 years for side one. We released side one in February of 2017, and side two we released on Halloween of 2017, October 31st or 30th. I can't remember what date I actually released it. So we're coming up on 2 years for the first release, and coming up on a year and a half for the second one.
And can you give us a peek into what it's like to take the interest of the KISS Army the way you have, and to have the sort of response you've had, and how much it may have surprised you?
It did surprise us, because we wanted to do this just for fun and just to get it out there and see if anybody would catch on or hear some of the familiar things that we are hearing when we're putting this stuff down, thinking, oh, some people may like this, particularly people or the original lineup, because that's the sound that we're going for. And then when we released the first one, we were shocked at how quickly word got around and how how people responded in such a positive fashion, because it connects with them in a on a nostalgic level for most people, because it reminds them when they were first discovering KISS, or when they were first discovering rock and roll, or when they first discovered those original records. Even if you bought your first record in 1989, most KISS fans went backwards to see what was going on, and then you get turned on to this whole other thing that happened in the 70s, and we connected with people like that, and it was amazing for us because we knew that we'd connect with some people, but we didn't realize it would be thousands and thousands of people.
Yeah, I mean, my first album was, we called it Dynasty in Australia, Dynasty, and I think I got it for Christmas, and then I immediately went back and bought the self-titled debut, and then I got them all in order. You know what I mean? And then I got them all on CD when they came out on CD. So I really, I can kind of, I got a similar experience. Maybe we should play a song, first up song, Tom. Have you got a song? What would you like people to hear?
You know what? Talking about Ace, if you can play Jendel from Side 2, I think people would get a kick out of hearing that. It's very Ace Frehley 1978 type of song.
Jendel, I'm so glad to be home. Jendel.
This is Tom from Classic 78, and you're listening to White Line Fever.
Welcome back to the program. We normally do the rugby league chat in the middle, but it's the end. It's the end of the program, and we're doing the rugby league chat at the end. Before I introduce our guest, I want to tell you that, and I should tell you, I should be doing this every single episode, saying that the podcast is brought to you by Mascot Browns. That's Browns with a Z. We do international rugby league merch, and the book Touchstones, which has been out about 18 months. Okay, we are sitting here at Houston Station in Ireland, and I'm here with a man who has just moved back to his homeland in the last 48 hours. It's Connor Kelly. How are you, Connor?
I'm not too bad, Steve. How are you?
Good, mate. I'm really good. Looking forward to going down to Tip for Christmas and not drinking and eating. For the listeners, you've obviously been involved in rugby league most of your adult life, and you've just moved back here for Coventry, from Coventry, where you were a player and an official. Can you tell us a little bit about your sort of rugby league journey, in sort of Reader's Digest version, you know?
Yeah, I suppose I'll start with one of the more unpopular parts of it, where I used to play rugby union. And then when I always watched rugby league on Sky Sports, on BBC, watching the Challenge Cup, and I sort of grew up. Boy, what came into my teenage years when Brian Kearney was starting to really make an impact in the game. So I remember watching him play for Wigan, and obviously he had a stint in the NRL. And I remember watching some of the great games, Andy Farrell, that great Wigan team at that time on Sky Sports most Friday nights, and I thought, it's something actually I'd like to play. And I did it. Once I got to 18, I started doing a bit of research to see if there was, I didn't even know if there was teams in Ireland at that stage. This is before Google was widely used or even smartphones, anything along those lines. So I remember getting in touch with Richard Egan, playing a couple of seasons with the Dublin Sea Exiles, which is how I started. Realised I wasn't that good of a player. Ended up taking up match officiating and doing some media work for Rugby League Ireland. And that led me back closer to where I'm from in Dublin. There was a group of guys setting up a team in Ballyfermot, and I remember going down to do some media stuff on them, and I just straight away clicked with the guys. And we ended up forming the club, initially the Ballyfermot Bears, then the West Dublin Bears. And I remember I ran that for a few years and ended up getting into coaching and doing all sorts, as you do when you're running an amateur club, and it's only a group of three or four people, you end up doing a bit of everything. So during that time we had a lot of young guys coming through, and these guys were 17, 18, playing in local schools. Rugby was not played in that part of Dublin at all. No one had ever even tried it, so it was completely new to them. People who'd watched on TV, they didn't even realise it was rugby league they were coming to play. They just saw the over ball and thought, we'd come and have a go at this. One of the guys who came down was actually a school teacher, and this is how it leads me to Coventry. So if you bear with me,
no pun intended, bear with me.
His name's Anthony McCreary. Anthony came to me and said, I run my local rugby team, but I want them to play rugby league in the school. I want some schools rugby league. Can you do it? And I obviously had a conversation with the RLI board. They said, yeah, go and do it. We did a one-day blitz in Drogheda with three schools. And from that, there were 60 lads there playing. From that, we evolved into an Ulster versus Leinster game, because one Wayne Kelly, who's been involved for a long time as well, he was teaching up in Ulster, and he had a team, and we talked about it, and we got a couple of games going. From there, we ended up doing international stuff, and the international board gave funding for underage development for the first time in a long time. So we used that to do some representative stuff for a couple of years. While I was doing that, I got a bit more of a feel for coaching and managing at a higher level. And obviously around that time, Coventry Bears were, after being accepted into League One, and from previous tours going to America, I knew Alan Robinson. So I had been talking to Alan about players in Ireland who he was interested in trying to get to Coventry. And I actually said to him, could I come over for a couple of weekends a year and oversee, like have a look at the coaching and the management to see what you do. One thing led to another, and I spent 4 years living there. I actually went in December 4 years ago, probably nearly to the day, for a weekend. I'd never been to Coventry. I didn't know anyone in Coventry other than Alan. I didn't even know it was near Birmingham until I did some research. And I flew over, and straight away I met people like Ron Brown, Tom Sang, and I thought, this is you know, this is for me, this is a great club, great people. And I got the opportunity, Alan had gotten funding from the RFL through the Sky Tribe project to have a community manager, so he offered that job to me. And obviously I went whole hog and moved myself over to Coventry, having only been there for 2 days before, so it was a bit of a jump.
Mm-hmm.
Bit of a leap of faith almost in Alan, you know, having the faith that I would have some, you know, some security over there. I remember the first weekend I went there, we actually went out to Spain. So I'd gone the boat over in my Irish car, everything I owned in the back of the car. Mm-hmm. Spent 8 hours on the boat to Liverpool overnight. Emphasis was closed. So I spent a good 14 hours travelling to Coventry. Now, in hindsight, I probably should have flown because it only takes an hour. But I spent 14 hours travelling there, and then straight away we went to Spain, spent the weekend there. And I remember when I came back from Spain, I didn't know where I was living.
Mm-hmm.
Alan had sorted the room out, but I didn't know where it was. We got back at midnight, and I got off the plane, I got off the train, and went, where am I meant to be going? Mm-hmm. Where am I sleeping tonight? And some of the lads walked me around, had to walk through Coventry at 1 o'clock in the morning, trying to find the house I was going to be living in. So it was certainly an experience after, you know, having lived in Dublin for all my life, to go to that was a bit of an eye-opener, but it was in a positive way. To, you know, I'd lived on my own before that, so I went to living with some of the players, James Gorch and Jamal Hunt. So some of the camaraderie and some of the antics in the house were a bit, were something that were alien to me at the time.
So Conor, why are you back here in Dublin?
I guess after spending 4 years in Coventry, I only planned to spend a year, and I ended up spending four, which is a lot longer. I think I just got to a stage in life where I thought maybe it's time to come home. I looked at what it was like in Dublin in terms of job-wise, and realised it was on a real uptrend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the city had changed a lot since I've been here, even in just a short 4 years. When I left, it was just coming out of the recession. And now it's obviously gone back in positive. Everything's positive. They're back building. They're back. There's all new fads. There's a donut fad now in Dublin, which wasn't there when I came back. Mm. You now have crispy people queuing for 2 hours outside of Krispy Kreme to spend €3 on a donut that's probably only cost 10 cents to make. So I just thought it was a good time for me to come back. I hadn't really, for the last 2 years I was in Coventry, I hadn't been massively involved in Rugby League in Ireland.
Mm.
This year I got back involved with the under-19s with the trip to Serbia, and that kind of gave me a passion for getting back involved at that level and trying to bring some of the knowledge that I've picked up from Alan and Tom and Ron Banks and people like that back to Ireland to try and help develop the game. So that kind of piqued my interest in coming back, and I think it just fit in well. I think 4 years is quite a long time to be away from home.
Mm-hmm.
For me anyway, having never lived away from home before. So I just felt it was a great opportunity to come home, and you know, obviously there's another project which I've started working on, which came up in that time as well, which people have been looking at for years and years. And I spoke to people and they said, let's try and do it now. Let's, instead of just thinking about it, let's actually go and move that forward and try and see if we can do it.
Mm. Now, what you're referring to is a Dublin team in the British system, I think everyone knows. It's sensitive politically. Before I ask you about the Dublin team and the British system, can you explain to people who wouldn't understand why it's sensitive politically?
I think it's sensitive. There's been a total change in the Rugby League Ireland board. Mm-hmm. Over the last few months, and there's a whole new host of personnel there who I haven't worked with before. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a feeling out stage here where we have mm-hmm. to get people have to get to know each other. Mm-hmm. Understand how people operate.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously they're I'm sure trying to get to grips with the development of the game, where the game is.
Mm-hmm.
And where they want it to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that if they hear there's a professional team coming to Dublin, they probably panic straight away, going, mm-hmm. we don't know what we're doing yet, how can we mm-hmm. manage this? So that's probably why it's politically sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
Now obviously the Dublin Blues, it's a long term project. It's not something that we're looking to do in 2019.
Mm-hmm.
Walk in and enter League One. It's mm-hmm. not, obviously it's too late to do that now, but mm-hmm. it was never on the table, which I think people believed was 2019, 2020. It's going to be a little bit longer than that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a big project. It's not it's not something that's done in Ireland very often. There's not many professional sports teams that set themselves up.
Mm-hmm.
All the teams that are professional have a long history.
Mm-hmm.
So it's something that's relatively unknown. Even the sport of rugby league is relatively unknown in Ireland. Mm-hmm. So to bring up what is to a lot of people a whole new sport in, mm-hmm. is a massive challenge. So,
Okay, so can you tell us, we've read some stories maybe in the last 12 months about it. So where is it at? You know, what's your involvement?
It's very much in the planning stage. We're looking at the business side of things, how we can operate as a business, how, you know, where will we get the revenue from, because it's going to cost a lot of money, including travel, maybe not as much as such as products such as Toulouse or Toronto,
mm-hmm.
where they're, you know, Toronto obviously are doing transatlantic flights every few weeks, so mm-hmm. the cost and the premise will be slightly different. However, it's still a team flying to games, teams having to commute to Dublin. Albeit a shorter journey. So we're having to look at the logistics. Is it possible? The business plan, will it be a success? Probably the stuff that people don't enjoy looking at,
mm-hmm.
that's what we're looking at now, so that's where it is. It's the inclination is to straight away look at who's going to play for us,
mm-hmm.
look at the players, look at the kit design, look mm-hmm. at the website, the social media, let's get, you know, all the glitzy and mm-hmm. glamour stuff. However, without the business side of things, that's irrelevant.
Mm.
So any logos, any jersey designs, any players, any, you know, stadiums, any, all that end of things is irrelevant until we know that's going to be a successful business.
Mm.
We know that's financially sustainable, and we know that's not going to have a negative impact on the game of rugby league in Ireland.
It would be remiss of me. We're going to do two interviews. We'll just do it all in one.
Yeah.
It'd be remiss of me not to ask who we are. You talk about yourself. Who's we?
I think I'll get in trouble if I say everyone. I've got some friends from over here involved in different industries. So I've people that I worked with in the media side of things who covered rugby league.
Mm.
So they have a good grasp of the media. They do a lot of radio stuff, they're one of the main radio sports presenters in Dublin.
Mm-hmm.
So they understand the landscape in media in Dublin. And I think that's the first thing we have to look at. We have to look at in Dublin. Because I've had a lot of people come to me and say, get, you know, ex-former Irish international to publicise in Ireland. Well, Irish Rugby League internationals generally are unknown in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so even though I know them, you know them, people think, you know, they're celebrities in their field.
Mm-hmm.
They're unknown in Dublin,
mm-hmm.
so rolling out an Irish international in front of a load of people in Dublin is just another former rugby player who they don't know. So
mm-hmm.
we obviously have to navigate the media in Ireland. We have to look at the marketing, how to market it. So I've got a marketing specialist in. I'm purposely not naming them
mm-hmm.
for the moment until we get a bit more foundation in place. So. And obviously I've been speaking to people like Alan Robinson, getting the voice off him, because he's done it, he's brought a professional team into from being amateur to professional, but he knows what it's like to run a professional team in a developing area.
Mm.
He knows the challenges of player recruitment, of sponsorship, of getting sponsorship, getting fans, getting people into the ground. But people like that are, when I say we, that's who I'm talking to directly and indirectly helping me. So
will it be has there been a submission to the RFL, or will there be one?
There hasn't at the moment. I have spoken to Ralph Rimmer personally and made him aware that it is something that's being looked at. In terms of a submission, it's still aspirational at this point. So to put a date on the submission, I think would be naive of myself. I don't think we're ready to do that yet.
Mm.
Obviously, when the project is at that point, there'll be a bit more public and people will know a bit more about it. I'll be able to say more about it as well. So
can this be done without the support of Rugby League Ireland, do you think? Because around the world, sometimes the local professional franchise rubs the local domestic authority the wrong way. We're seeing Canada, they don't seem to get on great, but the Wolfpack in Canada. Would you obviously rather have them on side?
Yeah, I think I would rather have them on side. I'd rather there be an agreement and a relationship there.
Mm.
I think at the moment they need to focus on getting their feet under the table and, you know, developing the game. And, you know, there's challenges there because it's a game that goes in cycles. It goes in cycles from having 12 clubs to 6 clubs. And goes, you know, and it is difficult to develop the game in a country such as Ireland where there's, you know, there's a lot of other sports that are ingrained in society. Sports like Gaelic football, hurling, soccer, rugby union, they're ingrained in society. I mean, you've probably seen it just driving through the city centre. You see all the advertisements and the sport people. So, to, you know, I appreciate their focus is going to be on developing the game, and the last thing they want to talk about is a professional team in Ireland. But I think in the best case scenario, yeah, there will be a relationship. Can it work without it? You've already cited a time where it has in Toronto and Canada, like you said, there probably is no relationship at all there. But they still make it work. Toronto still make it work with everything they're doing there in terms of publicising the game. And that in effect benefits Canada Rugby League because Rugby League is being brought to 6,000-7,000 people every time they play. That wouldn't have happened before, would it? So, and then obviously that's not even talking about TV audiences in Canada and, you know, some of the other stuff that they're doing off the field. So I think, yes, there would be a massive benefit to be a link there and to be a relationship.
Do you have a rich guy? Do you need a rich guy?
We probably need a rich guy. We don't have one at the moment. but I think again, we need to go back to the business plan to show, so we can show a rich guy or anyone who's looking to invest that's viable. If we show them a business plan where it's hemorrhaging money, who's going to want to be involved in that? No one's going to want to be involved in something where it's saying, oh yeah, you need to shell out X million a year and you're not going to get any return. So that's the challenge. That's where we have to get those selling points put together. We have to get a solid business plan where someone can look at and say, yes, I want to be a part of that. Without that, it remains aspirational and remains just a hope and a dream.
Is it right there's only a very small number of professional teams of any sport, but particularly professional rugby teams in this country? So from the playing pool point of view, you're going to have quite a good sort of well of talent there, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, there's professional soccer league, so there's probably about 20-odd professional soccer teams. In terms of rugby, there's four. So there's your provinces, Connacht, Leinster, Munster, Ulster. Outside of that, there's no professional rugby. So there is a player pool there. Each of them have academies and sub-academies, and they have a lot of players coming through their systems that aren't going to make it. And it's similar to Super League academies. They have a lot of players coming through their system that just they're not ready to make it at that time. So some of them will drop Championship League One. And we'd hope that we could get some guys to convert and give Rugby League a try. And, you know, it has been seen before where rugby union players have converted. I mean, even just this year, Ed O'Keefe, who came through the Munster and Connacht system, played for Ireland. And I know he went on trial with Lee, and he's looking to try and play rugby league professionally. So there are players there who'll do it. The challenge that they face is if they want to play professional rugby league at the moment, they have to leave Ireland. There's no two ways about it. You have to go to England, and you have to go to, realistically, you probably have to go to League One or Championship, because there's not a lot of Super League teams who are willing to take a punt on an unknown player. Obviously, because of the investment side that they're putting in terms of paying the player, they then obviously, the players want to get game time. And they'll only develop with game time, so there's no point in a weekend signing an Irish player to sit on the sideline and not even make the reserves, for example. So for me, the players that, if we get young players, say 17, 18, who can come go to England initially, they will develop quicker than the guys who stay here. Now, unfortunately, not all of them are in a position to do so. So it is a big commitment. I've done it myself. I know what they're facing, and I've had, I mean, over the last 4 years, I've spoken to over 20 guys in the domestic system about coming to England to play. Now, only 5 of them actually have done that. So that goes to show you the challenge they are being faced with that pathway. Now, obviously, I believe that if they didn't have to make that move, if they could play it without leaving home, we would see more people play the game, because that opportunity is there. There's a carrot there for them. And also with that, then it will develop players for the national team. So the argument of heritage against domestic won't be the same, because we'll have a group of players playing professional rugby league in Ireland, who are Irish qualified, that will have the experience now. They'll be closer to the, to that level. They won't. I'm not saying they're going to be superstars or we're going to be, you know, walking a team into Super League after 3 years. Like, but if we develop players over long term, we've seen little glimpses of players who can do it. You know, we've seen Ronald Michael who's gone to Huddersfield now, won himself a contract, and really did himself no harm when he played in this senior internationals. He didn't look out of place for an 18-year-old guy who played only a small amount of rugby league. So if he can be developed in the right way over the next 3 or 4 years, who knows what level he can play at. You know, and obviously Huddersfield see something in him, so there is a potential for him to play Super League. You know, we haven't had an Irish born Super League player since Brian Kearney. That's a long time. I'm sure Brian won't be too happy to hear that.
Yeah, I'm getting married at the moment. The John's boys are over for his wedding, so yeah, congratulations, Brian. Okay, Connor, thanks for that. Make sure you catch us on Twitter, WLF Podcast, Facebook / WLF Podcast, and subscribe and comment on iTunes. And Connor, I'm giving you the honour of picking a song to close the programme. What have you got for us?
I think I'll go someone, a local rock star, well, former rock star, unfortunately, Thin Lizzy. We'll go Whiskey in a Jar.
So maybe seven. In walked Captain Farrell. I jumped up, fired off my pistols, and I shot him with both barrels. Mushering, dumma doo dumma da. Wait for my daddy, oh. Wait for my daddy, oh. There's whiskey in the jar. And some men like to follow them. And some men like to hear a cannonball roaring. But me, I like sleeping, especially in my mileage chamber. But here I am in prison. Here I am with a ball and chain, yeah. Much a ring, dumma do dumma da. Wait for my daddy, oh. Wait for my daddy, oh. There's whiskey in the jar. And I got drunk on whiskey, oh. And I love, 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 I love.
I got a white line fever. Going to run land down under. Going to turn around the corner way down yonder. But I'm not even going to try to rhyme anymore. Michael Monroe here for White Line Fever. And you get a chance, come and check us out live. We're going to rock your socks off and whatever. Rock like fuck. That's what I say, okay? Come on down and rock on.